I got permission to play this new song, so we're going to start the show off a little bit different this morning.
Parallel paradox. Call it the dox a little.
Waking up, I check the price of Bitcoin. Scrolling on down through the shitcoins. Hot damn, I'm up 20 bands. Less is once again like ooh, ooh, ooh. My account's at an all-time high. When big bull tar make bearers die. Eat Milky Bar, so the price is gon' fly away. Today, I pray. Got my bags packed, do you wish you had that? Try to tell the normies they ain't listen how they sad, sad. Big BTC, lil bro E, GRT, I've been telling how to grab that. Bought link, I ain't even do no research. Carry round bags so heavy that my knees hurt. Please sir, this is for my family. I've been buying daily for prosperity. Okay, you got your suicide stack. All in Bitcoin, I don't need no cash. Fuck cock bucks, they suck. I don't wanna pay stub. You can keep the cash, I'ma stack until that day comes. Lambo, moonshot, I believe since day one. Elon finna pump this shit to Mars, no need to say none. If you've been on the sidelines, I'ma win, it's my time. Jumping on you fast, here hold my legs and watch them decline. Waking up, I check the price of Bitcoin. Scrolling on down through the shit coins. Hot damn, I'm up 20 bands. Lessons once again, like my account's at an all-time high. When big bull tart and bearers die. Eat Milky Bar, so the price is gon' fly away. Today, today I pray. Shout out all the homies who just stack and stack. Mighty Vent, Matt O'Dell, Mr. Swan and Max. Every fellow OG, RCD, Moon Dart, R&R, Loops, and Kobe. If you don't know me, this is wrong hands only. Have fun staying poor if you capitulate, homie. I could never do that, hardly ever go flat. Small team won't do full send if a ham can. I'm long with a whole stack, I'm Giga Brain Bull Chat. Okay, here's what happened before the IRS mad. I went full bull tart and the bearers died. It sounds tall tales, but it's no lie. See, I lost all my money in the exchange hack and the boating accident that happened after that. Plus, I'm down a couple racks from when I bought Z cash. It's okay, I'll write it off, whatever helps the tax, yeah. Waking up, I check the price of Bitcoin. Scrolling on down through the shit coins. Hot damn, another 20 bands. Blessings once again, like ooh, ooh, ooh. My account's at an all-time high. When big bull tar make bearers die. Eat Milky Bar, so the price went and flew away. But that was yesterday.
Your ATM is safe. Your bank's...
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 61 of the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces. My name is Coleman. I am your host, and today we have a special guest. We have Ken Egan joining us. I want to say good morning, sir, and good morning to Bob Van Kirk as well. How are you gentlemen doing?
Good morning, Coleman. Doing great. Sitting back with a cup of coffee, looking forward to our discussion.
Excellent. Yeah, so I'm really excited for this, Ken. We were acquainted by just a mutual friend. Questions I'd like to ask you. Before we dig into that, I want to make sure everybody understands the reason that we do this show every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Hey, Ken, you have a hot mic on right now. Do you mind turning it off? Thank you, sir. And the purpose of the show is to make sure that everyone understands what our founding fathers fought for shouldn't be taken for granted, and that we do not support tyranny in any way, shape, or form. And the way that we counter this is through Bitcoin, through this decentralized digital asset, this digital currency that allows us to escape the rails that are so corrupt. Bloated government, big government, their spending, their inefficiency. We don't need them anymore, and that we can utilize this to be more effective and prosper and have a means of savings to get off this fiat hamster wheel. I'd like to point everybody to our efforts that we did in North Carolina with Operation Gabriel. That operation is still going on. We're still going out and helping and assisting others. Right now, we're still trying to make sure everyone has warm weather clothing. This is the winter months, especially up in the Appalachians. And so it's getting cold at night. It's getting below freezing. So we're making sure that everyone has warm weather gear, blankets, heaters, generators. And the big push we've been trying to assist with recently is the tiny homes. So mobile homes, tiny homes, getting them set up and allowing these families to have some place to stay, have a roof over their head until they kind of bounce back on their feet. So I don't want you guys to think that we've stopped with this operation or we've just kind of thrown the towel. Like, it's continually going on. We still have communications going in the background channels, assisting everyone. So we do like your support, and we really do appreciate how generous you were in helping us raise over $115,000. So again, a huge thank you to all of you. But without further ado, I would like to welcome our guest, Ken. And if you don't mind, Ken, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. And again, thank you for the invite. It's what a great week to be here. Not just the price. I mean, the price is nice, but it's not all about the price. But also, as you all know, we celebrated Veterans Day this weekend. I actually never served in the military, but my father did, and my grandfather did. So there's a history of service in my family that I think drove me to sort of my previous career. So yeah, I've been in the Bitcoin space since about 2019. And it's funny, I only actually discovered Bitcoin because of my previous work at CIA. I was an operations officer. I spent most of my career overseas. I spent the first half of my career in the Middle East. Post 9/11, war and terror. That was kind of what I did for the first half. After sort of mid-career, I did a switch. I started working on Asia issues, but it was really in 2018 when I got an assignment at CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence, that CIA cyber unit, where the space opened up to me. And it wasn't because I didn't go there because I was interested in Bitcoin. It was sort of the opposite effect. When I first got there, I was in a group that managed cyber threats. And remember, this is 2018, so I think this is when North Koreans, Lazarus Group, were really ramping up their operations, robbing, altcoin platforms and crypto exchanges. Ransomware became a critical issue on the national security front. And really the government at large, was sort of way behind the times in understanding this ecosystem. And that's how I got involved, but it was the cyber center, right? So I was very lucky. I had to learn about it. But I had some people, I met some people who had been home mining Bitcoin in 2013. Were able to teach me. And as the more I learned about it because it was something I had, for me, it was just part of the problem, right? Foreign actors were using Bitcoin and cryptocurrency to do things that we didn't like. So learn about it. But like everything else, and like so many, I don't ask for admissions of guilt, but I admit it. Like I first got it, I owned every altcoin in the book. I went through that process. By 2020, I was, I had cleaned my act. I was altcoin free. But anyway, it taught me valuable lessons, not just about about the but the space, but again, but why Bitcoin was important. I ended up going down the rabbit hole. And it's funny. I think there's sort of a, and I deal with this now. This can tell you some stories about this, but sort of, as a CIA officer and, in Bitcoin circles and Austrian circles, sometimes the CIA is not particularly well regarded. I was very lucky. The person introduced us and, the local Bitcoin Devs Club, was really welcoming. Maybe because it's in the DC area that there are some other people there who would work in the intelligence community. So I never sort of had that, like, why are you here? Feds kind of thing, which I appreciated. But as I sort of went further down the rabbit hole and, it opens up your mind to so much things. I think I said this and I wrote a post not too long back that, I don't think Bitcoin's an ideology, because ideology sort of force you into, they pigeonhole you into thinking into thinking certain things, to putting everything into a framework. For me, Bitcoin really illuminated. And the thing that it really, and I recognize this now, I've been out of government for 2 years now. And what it really gave me, is it cured my cynicism. You work in a place like CIA, and it's very easy to become cynical, not because the CIA is doing bad things, but the whole focus of your life is tackling challenges, problems, and some of these problems are very difficult. So it's very easy to become cynical because, the world's falling apart and, we're in decline and, you've all heard it's all the same memes. But you look at something like Bitcoin and when you meet the community and you see what people are doing in the community, the builders, what it offers, the adoption, how it changes lives in places even outside the United States, for me, it cured my cynicism. And that's been a really tremendous sort of emotional load off your shoulders. Cause now I see it's very easy to look at the world and say, oh, China's going to overtake us or this is going to happen or we're in decline. And look, but when you see a path that's available to everyone, that opens up hope, and this is not hopium, right? I like price pumps. I'd rather my Bitcoin be worth more than less. But it opens up, there's something to that. And that's why since I left government in 2022, I've been doing a lot of advocacy work. I draw a lot of sort of personal pleasure from it. It means a lot to me and I'm really happy to be able to do it.
Before we start touching on the work you're doing with the Bitcoin Policy Institute, I'd like to kind of go back just a little bit. What was your aha moment when you realized that Bitcoin was hope? Bitcoin was an escape from everything going on and everything that you were seeing. Can you remember a specific time?
Yeah, it was. It was actually during sort of the during some of the it was, and I was very lucky. I'm a reader. I'm a bibliophile. I collect books. And there are a couple of books I read early that opened up my eyes. I've always sort of been. I've always been a classical liberal. I've always believed in free markets. My ideological inclinations were there, sort of my temperament. But I think what tripped it for me, was COVID, and the lockdowns, the debanking, oftentimes at gunpoint, seeing images of, police firing paintballs at people. And for me, that red, and the other Canadian truckers, that's what registered for me. The need to be able to, and for me, what really drew me to it first was the ability to transact without intermediaries. That for me, because again, since 9/11 and, your national security, you understand like how the dollar is weaponized and the power of the dollar. There's a hole in Washington DC. There are people that spent their entire careers since 9/11 working in the dollar, right? Making the dollar, tool of foreign policy. And that's, I think Treasury stopped even publishing the statistics, but there's been, 1,000% increase in the use of sanctions, since 9/11. And not that all sanctions are bad, but, there's an impact to it. But when I watched in the sanctions are applied to North Korea or Iran, you don't think about it because, they're an adversary and, fine. When those sanctions are applied to people who are expressing their opposition to lockdowns or to mandatory vaccines, all of a sudden, it triggers. And, when you work at CIA, you have a good understanding of the power the government wields, what it can do to you if it wants to. So for me, it was COVID. It wasn't even the economics of it. It was the censorship, and the ability to, what I determined, you know, critical need to be able to secure my wealth, dispose of my wealth as I saw it without needing anybody else's permission.
So then you would, because we're going to have a lot of first-time listeners, first-time people finding Bitcoin with the price doing what it's doing in recent days. So one of the things a lot of people push back on is, you know, well, the government can just stop Bitcoin. They can go ahead and take it from you. You know, they can prevent you from using it. Can you go ahead and reiterate that was kind of your aha moment, is that this was an escape from the government overreach?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And I had this discussion with a lot of friends of mine, and, you know, people that have, and again, I went to college in Washington DC. Yeah, I worked for the government. Yeah, I grew up in New York, but I've been a, you know, I'll use the word creature of the DC area for a long time. So, you know, my friends, my social life is all here. And I have a lot of friends who work in and out of government, smart people, and they don't take the leap. They have a difficult time making the leap from why that matters. They say, you know, my bank's not gonna run out of money. I have a banking app, and these things are all true. But I think COVID in 2020 in that time was the first time that I think most Americans, saw that there was there's an inherent tendency in all these powers that the federal government amassed to wield it in a way that target political enemies. And we're not talking about, you know, throughout the Cold War, right? We were, you know, arresting communist spies, that sort of thing. But these are political enemies, sort of generally speaking, inside the Overton window, right? Of what most people consider reasonable perspectives on issues of the day. And I think people need to understand that, and not just the government, but if, you know, for example, if just pick a bank, right? If Wells Fargo decides that they want to bank you, they'll do it. And there's no recourse because it's a private institution. They could do that. But what does that leave you? I think most people get to it. At least my experience has been, and most people get to it through economics, and sort of general concepts of liberty. I came at it, but the way I came at it was very sort of specific to my own background, right? Sort of the things that I saw that I knew the government could always do. And everyone inherently knows the government wants to take my bank account. They can do it. There's nothing I can do about it. Throughout my youth, I'm a Gen Xer, right? Yeah, I never saw that power wielded against citizens in a way that I thought would have been sort of unreasonable, right? Criminals, right? Drug dealers, fine, yeah, take their money. You know, it's ill-gotten gains. Never though would I have thought that someone would be debanked or censored because they didn't want to have a vaccine, or they didn't believe that they shouldn't be able to go to church. Intimately familiar with the power of the government, when that light bulb goes on that, yeah, they can't actually wield it against you for what you might expect to be, that again, views that are, or they're perfectly within the mainstream. None of these people were advocating overthrowing the United States government, right? They just want to be left alone, and pursue their conscience. That for me, I think people need to recognize that. I think the economics argument is really the fundamental piece. I think that's why I think you see, I tell the Bitcoin, some of my friends in Bitcoin, they're like, you're crazy. I think the biggest thing that happened to Bitcoin, in the past couple of years is Larry Fink. It's not necessarily that he's Larry Fink, but it's the radical transition. It's watching him flip from like it's rat poison, really one of our, I think one of the most articulate advocates for sort of the base case for Bitcoin. People might like not like the ETF. I don't own the ETF. But nonetheless, you know, he's making a case in a way, and this is a pillar of the establishment, right? Making the case that Bitcoin offers all these things that average Americans, that your everyday American who has a couple of dollars to save and invest, needs to consider.
So that's perfect. With the sanction part, Were you still part of the CIA cyber unit when we sanctioned Russia? And how do you think Russia viewed those sanctions? And can you give any insight as to if you believe that they're actively studying Bitcoin to circumvent the US dollar and its restrictions?
Yeah, I mean, I was, the war happened in February 2022, right? And I left in October of that year. So yeah, I was still in service at the beginning of the war. We'll start from a base case, right? If you're a strategic adversary of the United States, China, Iran, Russia, I use the word adversary broadly, but which is, you know, people that generally speak, countries that we generally speak of view as adversarial, you understand that your exposure to U.S. dollars is a weakness. It's a vulnerability to your national security. And I think that, for instance, these countries view getting out from underneath that umbrella is a national security imperative for very obvious reasons, right? Because the day comes, you know, your large swaths of your wealth can be confiscated. But it also impairs your ability to build bilateral relationships with other countries, because no matter who you do business with, on some level, Washington D.C. is in the middle of that transaction, right? Because their dollars going back and forth on some level. I think the fundamentally there, this has been, I think, you know, you see that the Chinese have stopped buying bonds, treasury bonds back in like 2009 or something. So I think that the countries understand it. And I think the Russia case just accelerated that, because the sanctions were broad and impactful. In the sense that, it hit areas that I think that we hadn't tread on before, certainly with a near peer adversary. We did it to Iran and to North Korea, but Russia is, you know, near peer adversary, and we did it to them. And so I think it registered for a lot of countries that not necessarily adversaries, because the Chinese have known this for a long time. The Iranians certainly have known this for a long time, but no country wants to have their wealth at the disposal of another. It's just normal, even adversaries, right? I mean, there's a reason why, the Gaulle sent the aircraft carrier to pick up, it wasn't the Gaulle, was it? The French sent aircraft carriers in New York to pick up their gold, right? It's not because they viewed the U.S. as an adversary. They just didn't like the fact that their gold was sitting in New York. I think the process, and it was always, and even secretaries of state have talked about this in the past. Even people involved in the sanctions have mentioned it. It is a blunt tool, and eventually, you use a knife long enough without sharpening it. Well, guess what? It gets blunt. And when you overextend use of a specific tool, it blunts. And I think the problem has been that it's been a very easy tool to wield, right? It allows people sitting in Washington to wield a lot of power, a lot of influence from their desks, right? It doesn't involve putting boots on the ground. You don't have to go eyeball to eyeball with the adversary. You can simply take their money, and it's impactful, because the ability to transact is the ability to breathe in the global economy, right? There's no country in the world produces everything they need to survive right now. So it's a very effective tool. But it's often wielded by people that are sort of, a little bit further back from the consequences of the actions. It's easy to put a few keystrokes up in downtown DC to freeze that bank accounts. But not understanding, because you're not thinking through the secondary effects of that. And I think we're seeing the secondary effects now. I think that we can talk about BRICS if you want. But I think
on that. Does the CIA, in your opinion, do they view the BRICS as a national security threat?
Like, I can tell you my own opinion. Like, I kind of don't. I do and I don't. I don't think the BRICS currency will ever be realized. And I can tell you why. I mean, if you look at that's sort of a motley assortment of countries, with all kinds of internal squabbles. You even start with the two biggest, right? Russia and China. Right? Like, the old PLA was a huge land force. It wasn't, a big land force was not built to fight the United States, right? It was built to defend the border, the Russian-China border. Russia, Putin's been able to exist largely because she has allowed Russia to breathe economically. But I don't know, is it Putin's vision to become a client-patron relationship with China over the next decade? I doubt it. They have a lot of, sort of conflicting interests in Central Asia. Egypt and, Ethiopia, right? Egypt views the Nile River is the economic engine. It's central to its identity, right? the Nile River. The Nile River goes deep into Africa, right? Down the Blue Nile, you know, how many thousands of miles south of there, the Ethiopians built a huge dam, on the Blue Nile that allows them to control the flow of water. The Egyptians view that as an existential threat, to their economic and, national security. Ethiopia views that dam as their right. It's on their territory and they need it to generate power. So again, these are difficult issues to solve. And then you know, the UAE and every Gulf country with Iran, right? Just, you know, no need to go into great detail of that. Well-known conflicts. You know, Brazil has just told, you know, vetoed Venezuela's membership. You know, there's a lot of challenges inside the concept of BRICS that I think that the idea of a unified currency is, I just don't think it's ever going to happen. I think, you could see them developing banking relationships, you know, removing friction for being able to swap currencies. I think they'll do all those things, in an effort to build sort of a spider web of infrastructure around the dollar system. But I think fundamentally it's the existence of BRICS is just even right now, it's symbolic. It's a symbolic show of power, even among allies, right? The UAE and Egypt would be considered U.S. allies. Even like Brazil is not an adversary of the United States. But it is certainly a message that, you know, we want to see alternative, structures built in the world that don't rely entirely on the United States. And I think, you know, that we think back to the post-war system, I forget the number. I think I wrote something about this. Like in 1960, there were maybe 100 members of the United Nations. The U.S. was like 40% of global GDP. Now it's not, right? It's 165, whatever the number is, members of the United Nations. The U.S. is 24% of global GDP. Right. The system that I think we're seeing evolve, I don't want to use the word unwinding, but maybe it is, but the system that I grew up in, that provided a lot of prosperity in the West, is changing. You pick a stronger, weaker adjective for that. It's definitely changing and it people are always surprised, but it's like, well, look, take a snapshot of the globe of the world back in 1960. That's right. When like the post-war system was really underway, take a snapshot now. It looks very, very different. So that people shouldn't be surprised that the system is going to evolve. It's the nature of things. And, you know, and the problem is that we're doing everything we can to facilitate that evolution, even though theoretically we should not welcome it.
So I have a question for you. And I think you're correct that I don't see the BRICS coming up with a currency amongst themselves, that'll work. But I do think that they have had heavy talks about Bitcoin. And so is it of your opinion that they are talking about it? And do you think that they could be the first group that decides to settle international trade in Bitcoin?
Yeah, I do. I mean, if I were a commodity producing country, that produced not just, you know, copper and gold and you know, make your pick, timber, but also energy that could mine Bitcoin. You know, why would I do it? Right. It's a great way to produce wealth that is outside the reach of the system. And I think globally, I think there are countries transacting in Bitcoin. Of course, like, you know, Tether gets a lot of attention because, you know, Tether is used globally for all kinds of things that, you know, official Washington might not like, but it's happening. I think a lot of the BRICS countries are also sort of quietly, building Bitcoin reserves. I think the UAE probably has a lot of Bitcoin. Anyway, I think the most interesting thing was we saw the day after the election, Chinese state media ran multiple stories about the strategic Bitcoin reserve, sort of highlighting it and talking about why Trump is doing this. You know, Chinese state media doesn't, you know, it's not like us. I can post whatever I want, right? Chinese state media posts things for a reason. So I follow a couple of Substacks that reflect that. Cause again, you get signaling out of it. And you know, China is still the second largest, still not global number two in hash rate. And that's just that in China, right? Doesn't speak to all sort of the operations that Bitmain is running throughout Africa. I think that signals that they understand that at least they, in their mind, see Bitcoin as an area of strategic competition. And that they tend to act. People can debate, like, why did Trump decide that to switch his stance and go pro Bitcoin? When you have an administration, right, in Washington DC, like all you need is, it doesn't matter whether he really believes it or not. What matters is that he signals to his administration. Cause again, there's the same 1,000 people that like these like deputy secretaries and assistant secretaries, I mean, these same 1,000 people that rotate between parties run Washington DC. They've been running forever and that's going to continue. But this important thing is that the signal is the appointees, the ones who implement policy are doing it in a way that's pro Bitcoin. So I think that's a significant change, but you know, sort of I drifted there, but back to your initial question. I think there are a lot of countries in the world that, I mean, Bhutan has $1 billion in Bitcoin, right? They had that happen. But we'll see, you know, Bitcoin is an easily convertible asset that they can store on their own. Even gold, right? Like how many countries store their gold reserves in London? Why not put a piece of your reserves into an asset that you can control, from your, you know, pick your office, your ministry you want to. And it's completely outside the reach of the U.S. regulatory authorities.
Hey, Jordan, you got a hot mic on, sir. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Oh, you're good. We enjoyed hearing you chew. So thank you, Ken. So again, just to kind of recap on that, I think we're of the same opinion that they are talking about it. And I think I was going to bring that up, the China news article that got released. So I'm glad you hit on that. I want to start transitioning a little bit to, some of the volunteer work you do, with, Bitcoin advocacy groups, specifically the Bitcoin Policy Institute. So, as you're going out and talking to these government officials, I'd like to kind of know, where are you getting pushback, if any, with Bitcoin and trying to get some of the policies through?
Yeah, it's been a great experience. I don't know what I went to, you know, I met the BPI guys a while ago. I did a few panels at the last summit in DC in April. And until because the focus of that summit was national security. And it sort of takes you back to a different time a year ago. And you know, The guy that runs national security at BPI, a guy named Matt Pines, a lot of you probably follow him. He's brilliant. We had coffee with him a couple of weeks or so back. We talked about the difference in, you know, what we see a year ago to today. And I think back to a year ago, you know, we were fighting for our backs. You know, there was tremendous momentum behind sort of a regulatory push. You call it Operation Choke Point 2.0, whatever, but there was a broad regulatory push in DC, politically and sort of administratively, to attack self-custody. They hate self-custody, elements of that crowd. They really hate it. There were some important legal cases that I think were the government's effort to set precedent, legal precedent, to be able to take action against other entities. And that sort of culminated in the April summit, the focus on national security, because the idea was to counter the narrative, specifically from Elizabeth Warren, that Bitcoin was the most horrible thing since fentanyl, right? It was just evil and needs to be banned, and here are all the reasons why. But it really was, definitely fighting for our backs. It was definitely fighting an uphill battle. All of a sudden, overnight, Trump was at a speech, and this guy, and I remember because this some crypto dude had like, you know, big sunglasses on. Trump said, called on the guy in the goggles, and he just states, he said, no, I'm pro crypto. I want to keep it here. I want Bitcoin to be mine in the United States. I'm pro crypto and I'm going to do all these things. And it just changed overnight. The reason why is because, you know, the fence sitters sensed the change in the force. And so we've done a lot of meetings, with Senate staffers and members of the Senate and in the House. And what I found, I mean, we didn't, you know, you don't go brief Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown, who's lost his seat, I think, in large part because of his opposition to what was called digital assets in general. You don't talk to those people because you know their position and they're actively adversarial. I won't dock people because that's unfair. But you know, we sat with a lot of staff and members, and the people, they were a lot of members who signed on to like Elizabeth Warren's bill, for example, because they just didn't really have, they had no strong opinion. She's an influential member of Congress. And so yeah, we'll sign on because I don't really care about Bitcoin or crypto in general. I don't care. So yeah, I'll sign on because it costs me nothing. And some were very honest about that. But that started to change once Trump started signaling that he was going to switch he switched his perspective on the ecosystem. And then money started flowing. There was a lot more, receptivity to the message. Like, tell me why. I'll be honest, like I sat with one member, who said, tell me why I should support this, right? Tell me why. Because this member just didn't have a strong opinion, and that's fine, right? Like, you know, not everybody has strong opinions. A lot of the members are older. Fine. It's okay. It's okay to admit that. But you know, tell me why I support this. Why is this good for national security? Why is this good for the economy? And you walk them through, a case, right? Why it's good for, you know, why Republicans can support it, why Democrats can support it, why it should be a bipartisan issue, why it's just good for America, and frankly, why it's good for the world. And you saw the shift, and the shift, I'll be honest, like Coleman, like it happened like in 15 minutes. It was crazy. Because again, I think there was a groundswell of, you know, and BPI was, played a big part in this, and sort of the larger ecosystem of sort of advocacy groups, members in this election years, right? Members getting phone calls and letters and emails to their offices saying, hey, I live in your district. I supported you last time, but I own Bitcoin and you oppose it. And then now I'm not voting for you. That hits home, for anybody who doesn't really have a strong opinion, that hits close to home, right? What's the ultimate goal is to stay in office, right? So the shift, you know, I think people expected a more protracted battle, that the anti-crypto army, would prove to be, you know, a little bit of a more durable adversary. And it wasn't, it folded. it folded pretty quickly. It folded really quickly. And that was the end. And then it was a function of members trying to sort of catch up, and sort of, you know, refine their positions on the issue. But it was really remarkable. I think Trump was a catalyst, but I think that was a catalyst for, there were a lot of other things going on in the background, right? Where advocacy groups were spending money and there were all kinds of grassroots movements, where members' offices, especially those in, because people smart were smart, right? You focus on contentious elections, where people were getting messagings from the districts. And I would imagine that even this issue might have probably popped into some polls and some campaigns. Do you own crypto? And do you own crypto? I'll just use that word. Do you vote because of crypto, right? And these people saw numbers and like, oh damn. Well, I'm in a tough congressional seat, and there's, I think Coinbase tells me there's 100,000 Coinbase account holders in my district. Ooh, uh-oh. I need to think this through, even though I don't really care about it.
So do you think that he will follow through then with some of the promises he's made and be an advocate for Bitcoin?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's the thing. Again, there's something we joke about, like, you know, like you let Bitcoiners in your tent, like, okay, but you know, it's a rowdy group, right? So Bitcoiners are going to hold you to it. Bitcoiners are in the tent now, for one reason, but yeah, I do. I think that it doesn't serve Trump. It serves no purpose to give him credit as that his views evolved. It serves no purpose for him to walk this stuff back. Politically, it's a nightmare because again, you all saw the Bitcoin Twitter over the past couple of months. I mean, he doesn't want that small but determined force turned against him, the political force turned against him. But again, I think it'll be a function of appointees, and I think that's where the discussions are happening now, right? Are they going to appoint people that are friendly to the industry? And I on some level, I think, you know, I get crap from this from some of my friends, in Bitcoin spaces, but you know, we have to accept that like the regulatory approach is going to be crypto, right? It's with the exception of maybe the Bitcoin Reserve, I think a lot of it's going to be crypto. I know, but it's just that's a lot of refinement for DC. But either way, I think the signaling will be in the appointments, of people who have relationships with the industry. I think that there'll be space for some Bitcoiners in the administration. So that's a long answer to a very simple question. I do think he's going to follow through because it's all the incentives are there. And I think that elements of his team have really come to believe that Bitcoin has a role to play in in not only in the economic future, but also in our national security.
Well, that's good to hear. Jordan, before we go to you with your question, sir, I just want to give a quick thank you to our partners, Black Sheep Ammo, Restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com. Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. Punch plate, make sure you stamp your seed phrase on a metal plate at punchplate.com. And Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms training at paladintowertactics.com. And do not forget, we have Bitcoin Alaska taking place July 5th and 6th of next year. You're not going to want to miss this conference. We recommend getting early, come in July 1st or 2nd, stay there for 4th of July, be a part of the Bitcoin Veterans Parade for the 4th of July parade, and then stay after. Alaska is beautiful. Juneau is beautiful. Alaska is beautiful in the summer, so do not miss out. Look in the nest and click on that link. Get your tickets and get your lodging soon because it will sell out quick. So go ahead, Jordan.
Yeah, in reference to the statement about how like the regulatory change and stuff, you know, Bitcoiners may not like it, but it'll probably be crypto in general as opposed to just Bitcoin. Like I agree that that's probably the angle it'll take, but also I kind of think that that's the right angle. And I say that more from like a principled perspective. Like I've been very well aware of how lobbying groups for a certain industry or even a certain company will try to get regulation and laws passed. And it may not specifically say that company's name, but it's always worded in a way to where it only affects them because the company that is hiring the lobbyists to get something passed, they're trying to do something that helps them, not their competitors as much as possible. And I always felt like that was like, that's a real issue. Like if you think changing this law for this industry is a good thing, well, then it should be for the industry as a whole, not one company within that industry. And I also have strong enough faith in Bitcoin compared to all other crypto assets that I don't really care to compete against them. And I think it's probably just a better play to just open this up to crypto in general. Now, does that mean that there's going to be some bad actors and some like scams and stuff? Yep. We're going to have to continue on education like that, but I don't think any of us really are going to want the government to just single out one company. It's also bad for us, or company. Bitcoin's not a company, but you know what I mean. If just Bitcoin were singled out and something were to like go wrong, or they have some kind of propaganda spin, it can all be focused against just Bitcoin. Whereas when it's the industry as a whole getting this regulatory or law favors, then you're going to see it's just going to be the bad actors that get singled out. And I think that's better for Bitcoin in the long run.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And it's sort of like the practical perspective. When you have a lot of lawmakers, there's a handful on the Hill that are, you know, that are, I would describe as Bitcoiners, filling your names. But you know, it takes more than a handful of lawmakers to get things passed. And you know, the reality is, the government really should not be picking favorites. I agree with you on that. And I think also a lot of the sort of the ideological motivation is on the Bitcoin side. On sort of the TradFi side, they want stable coins. They want stablecoin regulation. So the government wants stablecoin regulation because, you know, Tether's, whatever it is, the 16th largest holder of U.S. debt. But there's a lot of the push is entangled with stablecoin regulation. So I think these things are going to go hand in hand.
What do you view the odds of the United States seriously pushing through, Senator Lummis's bill? Strategic Bitcoin reserve. Is it just a talking point? Is it just Bitcoiners and Bitcoin Twitterverse, with Hopium, or does this actually have some legs underneath it?
So you have, an influential senator who has a bill, and you have a White House that has said we support it. So those are, that's two legs of a three-legged chair, right? You need the House. Republicans will control the Senate. There's always a chance that you'll have some Republicans who don't like the idea for various reasons, and you may even have some Democrats that like the idea. I think you have a decent chance of getting a bill out of the Senate. I think a lot depends on what the House of Representatives ultimately comes down to. I don't even know what the status is right now. But you need that third leg of the chair, right, to get a bill passed. I think he's serious about it. And it's been great. There's been a lot of memes about, you know, I guess if one tries to get the Twitter account that's highlighting every day how much money the Germans have lost because they sold this summer, but that holding into, you know, like right now at, we're at
92.
Almost $90,000. Think about that. Yeah. Crazy. So I do believe the issue, like everything else in Washington on the practical side is like, he's going to come into office. The new Congress is going to get set up. And then what are they going to prioritize and what are they going to push? You know, I do think again, Senator Lummis has a bill. The White House, President Trump has said it. I want this. So I mean that, you know, yeah, I think you have to at some level take that at face value. Will it happen? It's hard to say. But there are a lot of things they can do through executive order, to, you know, don't, for example, not to liquidate the current holdings. The U.S. government, I think, is still the biggest Bitcoin holder in the world, right? With the exception of Satoshi. It is, right? I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So again, huge holder. There's no burning need. I mean, we can pay it. You can sell it now and pay 15 minutes of the debt interest, right? Or you can hold it. But I think that the bigger issue in the bill is like, are they going to convert? Because holding Bitcoin that is, there's been a lot of critical discussion about this, certainly on the Nostra side. Is what we want is the government confiscating Bitcoin from people and holding it. Okay, fine, it's a fair point. But the fact is that the government is going to continue to confiscate Bitcoin, the fact is, the reality is Bitcoin is used by criminals sometimes. That's just the nature of it. Everybody can use it. So it is what it is. And the government is going to continue to seize Bitcoin, forever. It's the way it seizes every other currency and source of wealth. But the trick in the bill will be, will they convert? Will it be gold conversion? And I think that's where you really get the government can easily hold the stuff and figure out a way to put it on the balance sheet. But will we start selling gold for Bitcoin? That's the real trick. If that happens, gloriousness. But that's why I think the bill's important.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
I'm reasonably optimistic.
Okay. Reasonably optimistic. So let's play this out that if it does have legs and it does get passed, what does that cause across the entire globe? What's the ripple effect of that taking place with your work with CIA and the cyber unit? Like,
well, it becomes an arms race, right? Like it becomes a Bitcoin arms race. Cause all of a sudden you have the dollar is in part backed by Bitcoin at that point, right? Countries do not want to find themselves in the same predicament that they have today. Where, you know, our ability to transact globally is Uncle Sam's always in the middle of it, right? Whether we want him there or not. If the United States government is now stockpiling Bitcoin, and functionally backing the currency with Bitcoin, we need to do the same thing. And again, the thing you and I both were going to mention this morning, I look back to the Chinese announcement. I think it's critical. I'm actually really curious to see what the Chinese do overtly on regulation. Cause I think it's technically still illegal to own Bitcoin in China, I think. But clearly they've got, you know, 20%, whatever the number is, 25% of the hash rate. So, you know, this is an authoritarian government that, you know, if you're doing things on the internet, they can find it. So clearly they turn a blind eye to it. And I think that statement signals that what their intent will be if we follow through with the strategic reserve.
Yes, I do think that there's already, I think Russia and China and the Middle East countries are mining Bitcoin. I don't know if they're necessarily going flat out and purchasing it with their treasuries, but I think we'd be naive to think that they're not pointing a lot of their natural resources to mining Bitcoin. The question I have for you though is, can you confirm or acknowledge if the CIA, especially the cyber unit, has read Jason Lowry's book and what their stance is on his thesis, if they think it's credible?
You know, I can, and I don't know. I can imagine that people read it. I don't know. I don't know. And again, I think that this will be let's assume that there is sort of an arms race, that I use that word because it's lack of a, it's easy to sort of translate. Let's imagine there is an arms race, to accumulate Bitcoin and accumulate hash rate. I think hash rate will end up being as important as actually owning Bitcoin, because you've control all the hash rate, you can control the network, right? On some level. I think if Bitcoin, does play this role, I think necessarily the intelligence community is going to have to take it on as an issue. I'll shill a book. The Bitcoin Today Coalition put out a great book, National Security in the Digital Age. I had the pleasure of, you know, putting on a blurb, and I had a little review in the back, and I was there with Senator Loomis and Lynn Alden. So I was very happy. I was very proud of myself. Rarefied company. Sort of walking through this and giving policymakers and intelligence, professionals a perspective on what that arms race might look like. Whether it's, you know, it's geographic competition in Africa, whether it is the emergence of electricity as a commodity, how it affects debt markets. So there is, on the sort of the analytic think piece side in Washington, global big Washington, there are people thinking about this. The intelligence community on some level is supposed to, looks forward, but also, you know, it has to deal with, you know, it deals with the priorities of the day. And I think if we hit an adoption cycle, like I think, well, I'll use the word hope, but, you know, I think there's a reasonably good chance we see, coming into January. I think necessarily people have to start thinking about the implications for national security.
That's fascinating. So it's extremely bullish. Again, not trying to like over speculate or say that it's going to happen, but it's just good to talk about and hear this side of it. I did throw that book, up in the nest. So if anybody's interested, there's a link up there. I just looked on Amazon. You can get it right there, just for a couple bucks. So definitely worth, always listen to people that are smarter than you. If someone recommends a book, definitely give it some time to look over. So, thank you for that recommendation, Ken. Another question I had for you is, as a Bitcoin advocacy, like pushing for certain things, you must get a lot of rejection. I know for myself, I receive a lot of rejection, not from women, but from friends talking about Bitcoin.
From men.
I was in the Marine Corps, so there was, had to spend some time with the Navy, Randy K. But how do you get over that? How do you overcome just that constant people brushing you off? Like, what are some of the tips and tricks that you utilize just to keep trugging forward and keep your head held high?
Yeah, for me, again, I have a big chat group. I graduated college, you know, 30 years ago. Been a while. But yeah, I still have a close group of friends. We have our chat group, and you know, and I am the only one other guy in the chat group, owns IBIT. Right? He owns the ETF. No one else owns anything. And these are smart people, right? Been around. I focus a lot on I hate to say it, but like you get people interested with price gains. That's just the way it is, right? Like I know that there's sort of a bit of an allergy in Bitcoin circles to talk about price. But gets people looking at this asset. I've been doing a lot of, sort of preaching on that. But I think the thing that I get the most receptivity out of is depreciation of the purchasing power of the dollar. People feel it. I think people didn't really feel it as much 10 years ago. But they feel it now. I have a chart that I just have ready to send anybody who asks, right? Purchasing power of the dollar from 1971 to today. And you know, it's just a gruesome look. And you ask people, you know, and people own all kinds of things, all kinds of stocks, people speculate, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I made the case to people that, you know, if you look at just the price chart, 1%, even 0.5% of whatever you're worth, right, is really some like really spicy sauce if this thing takes off, and at least you'll have exposure to it. Cause we're 15 years in, whatever it is, and like we've surpassed the market cap of silver. Silver's been around a long time. So right, and cause you know, you hate to say it, but you both dealt with this. People get like, you know, once they become entrenched, they don't want to change their mind. And I've made people, you know, I, you know, I've made the case to people, like, you don't buy a stock and hold it forever. You know, you don't marry, this is, these are, you know, we're talking about money here. You know, you don't get wedded to it. You know, take a look at it, and really think through it. Which is what, again, it was that, like, convinced that one friend of mine to buy the ETF in his retirement account, because he was like, okay, yeah, what's a small allocation, can really, you know, add some juice. And I think owning it is what gets people, because when you own something, all of a sudden you take interest in it. Maybe read about it once in a while, and then I think that's what gets people hooked. But yeah, it's been purchasing power for sort of no coiners. I call them, you know, pre-coiners, right? I'm still optimistic about that. And I keep telling them, it's okay. Your kids are going to own it. So it's fine. You don't want to buy it. But your kids are going to buy it. So why not buy it for them now? But again, it's purchasing power of the dollar. That for me has been where I get the most people in price action to say, oh, okay, this actually is an interesting asset.
Well, thank you for that explanation. Really quick, I just want to give a couple shout outs to some of the listeners I see consistently tuning in. So Lynn B, I want to say good morning. Z-Mac, Matthew, BitCat, I want to say thank you for tuning in every single day. Jordan or Bob, did you guys have any specific questions? I know I've been asking a whole bunch for Ken, but is there anything that you wanted to ask?
Man, I'm just soaking it up. Good info. I appreciate you being here, Ken.
Yeah, same. I'm just enjoying the conversation, and I will chime in when I have something, but this has been great.
So perfect. I'm glad everyone's enjoying it. Ken, what are some of the biggest risks that you see for Bitcoin in the near term, and then also on a long-term horizon?
Yeah, so if you asked me this question a year ago, I would have said it was regulatory capture. So one of the things, and I like that, I saw that, I think we're past that now. And again, as the U.S. goes, the world will follow on this issue, I think. I actually think, so there's an other side to adoption. And I think that Lynn Alden, and I forget, his Twitter handle, I forget, did a paper on consensus. I think mining centralization fine, but I actually worry about consensus. Because again, let's imagine a world where, you know, where this is a...
Hey, Ken, really quick. Yeah. We're going to have a lot of new people tuning into this. Can you explain what consensus is and what you mean by that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, consensus and how changes are made to the protocol. Right? It's decentralized. No one controls it. So how are changes? But changes have to be made, right? It has to be maintained. People are adding things to it. So, the process by which Bitcoin is changed, upgraded, but yeah, by how it's changed. Let's imagine a world where this is a $10 trillion, $30 trillion asset, where national governments have parts of their wealth, tied up in it. Institutions have lots of their wealth tied up in it. People are going to start to care, what that process is. Right now it's, you know, with the benefit of, you know, a small group of developers who've worked together for a long time, who know each other. There's sort of an informal kind of way it happens, how they communicate to each other. I worry that, you know, in the future, you know, when this asset, if that takes off and a significant portion of global wealth is stored in it, governments and large institutions are going to care. And they're going to have opinions. And governments and large institutions can run nodes, they can run miners, they can hire developers. So I would like to see, my hope is that before that happens, there's sort of a new idea. And I don't have any strong opinions about this we're really hitting the edge of my technical ability here, but I'd like to see a more durable way for consensus changes, because I worry about, you know, I don't think self-custody is a threat right now. I think banks will be able to hold Bitcoin. But the protocol will persist, and how does it change? How's it maintained, and who gets to decide that? I think inevitably, after all the euphoria, people are going to start asking that question.
What about for long term then? Or is that your long term?
Yeah, that's sort of my long term, because, you know, you, you know, that's for me is the thing. Long term, I thought long term over the next, you know, call it 2 decades, right? Can you easily build in, you know, you could build in KYC, right? You could limit, you know, there's other things you can do, right? You could whitelist transact, you could whitelist addresses, all kinds of things you could do once you start tinkering, to make that protocol fit into what, you know, what large stakeholders want. And again, I don't think it's a problem right now. It's going to come. Like, if we think to ourselves that let's imagine that the U.S. government does buy a lot of Bitcoin and holds lots and lots and lots of it. But there are still these developers who like have, you know, go by monikers on like Noster. Like, is the U.S. government really going to be like, no, it's fine. We'll just trust these people. We don't know who they are, to tinker with this thing and to build it and to change it. No, they're gonna express an interest. And it's better if there's some kind of process that at least we can fall back on and say, no, here's the process, as opposed to sort of a more informal setup.
Does the amount of Bitcoin that the ETFs and MicroStrategy, I'm going to throw them in there because they have a large amount, does that concern you at all with a potential fork happening?
Yeah, in a sense, again, but kind of for the same reason, right? Like, what if all of the, let's imagine a world 5-6 years from now where, you know, global pensions, everybody's got an allocation, right? And there's Bitcoin and pension funds and all our 401ks and everybody's got it, whether they want it or not. It's just one of those things that's, you know, passive investing now includes owning ETFs. A lot of money. You know, these same institutions, you know, have the resources to hire developers and they're going to have opinions and they're going to have interests. How's that dealt with? So I don't honestly think it's the number of coins. It is in the sense that it's not that, as you all know, there's no voting here, right? But it does increase it does ramp up the potential, it's gonna ramp up their concern about that, but they want to protect their money, right? And that money's locked up in a network. And they're gonna have strong opinions about how that network should run.
Oops, sorry about that. Okay, perfect. So I'm glad to hear you're not super concerned, but there is a possibility for it. So we are reaching to the top of the hour. So I'm gonna start wrapping everything up. Ken, is there anything that we can do to help support yourself with what you're doing with the advocacy groups and with the BPI?
Yeah, no, I think what I get, I love your daily intelligence bulletin. I told a friend of mine, like, if you really want to go hardcore, you got to attach like a 20-page PowerPoint to it, so like all the former like DoD people can like, oh, there it is. It's, you know, modern art DoD PowerPoints, right? But I think it's a great product. I think veterans groups have an outsized voice, still in American politics. It's really important that, I know there's a tendency in the Bitcoin community to say, I don't engage in politics. I don't care. And you don't really have to engage in politics, but there's nothing wrong with your members when these bills come up or you see things in the press, writing to their representatives, let them know, hey, by the way, I live in your district and I saw this, I saw your speech and this is great. Thank you for saying it. For about Bitcoin, or the opposite, right? Like, hey, I saw you made this and let me explain to you why you're wrong in a nice way. I think that's important because there's still, at the end of the day, it boils down to like politicians want to stay in power. And the political winds, you know, I don't know what it is about the modern world, but they seem to blow stronger than they used to, at least when I was young, right? Everything is an issue. So the engagement you guys are doing with the veterans community, it's tremendous. And I think the veterans are natural Bitcoiners on some level. But certainly the overall liberty freedom message, I think, resonates with veterans, people that have skin in the game. Continue what we're doing. And I think, you know, finding ways to broaden that scope to larger parts of the veterans community. Essentially doing what we're doing. I think that's really important.
Well, thank you. And, shout out to Randy K for doing the Daily Intelligent Bulletin every day. So he's the one. If you're not following him, go ahead and give him a follow. He's always got good contact, very level-headed, so definitely recommend. And then also follow our handle, the Bitcoin Veterans. That gets posted Monday through Friday right around 7 o'clock Eastern time. So make sure that you tune into that. But I do like, Ken, that again, we've had a couple guests over the last couple of weeks, and the main message that everybody is reiterating is that it all starts at the local level. I know Bitcoiners want to change the world. We want to make it to what we see, but we can't change the world. We have to change our local communities. And so I like how you hit on that. Start with your local elected officials. Go out there and praise them or call them out for what they're doing, and you'll have more of effect with that. You can't move the mountain by yourself, but you can start picking up stones. So start with your local community. So I really do appreciate that. So Ken, this is an open invitation. I really enjoyed our conversation. I don't think I got through a quarter of the questions I had for you. So, anytime you want to come back on, you're more than welcome to. And I think I speak for everybody. This was a really fun, and engaging, conversation we had. So I just want to say thank you. Did you have any final comments you wanted to get out?
No, that's it. No, again, I agree. A lot of fun. I'm glad that our mutual, I appreciate that our mutual acquaintance connected us. Yeah, I tune in from time to time. I love what you do. I will certainly. I'm happy to come back anytime. Look for me on the listener role, because I'll be there.
Definitely, I will. And so with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap everything up. Again, I want a huge thank you for everybody tuning in and tuning in consistently. It really does mean a lot to me. But you've heard it over the last couple of days. Again, get out there and just talk to your friends, talk to your family, talk to your local elected officials, and just make sure they hear the message. Last week I challenged you over the weekend. When you go out and pay for something, even if it's at Walmart, I already know the answer, and I'm sure you do as well, but ask them, do you accept Bitcoin? You're planting that seed in there. You're getting them to think about it. Again, this race is not going to be won overnight. It's not going to be won over the next 4 years, even with the pro-Bitcoin administration coming in. It's going to take time. Be patient. Don't get frustrated, and just relax and have fun with it. Again, everybody will find the price of Bitcoin and discover it at the price they deserve. But hopefully if we're patient and just, you know, we keep spreading the same message, they'll catch on sooner than later. So that's my goal again for everyone tonight and this afternoon. Please go out there and just keep talking about it. Don't necessarily focus on price too much. Show them the options, and or not the options, what it can do for everybody, how it just gives you freedom. So go out there and spread that message. We did our Bitcoin Video Veterans podcast last night, Shane and Mike again. So make sure if you missed that, go to our YouTube channel or click our Twitter channel and go ahead and find the link. It was a good episode. Other than that, we'll be doing this again tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock Eastern time. Tune in. It's just going to be us. We don't have any featured guests tomorrow, but I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about and cover over the next 24 hours. So I want to thank you again and have a fantastic day. But don't shitcoin. It's like buying a lottery ticket with yesterday's numbers.